Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is part two of the Johnson-Bentley family murder. So if you are yet to have listened to part one, be sure to do that because we're diving a little bit deeper today. My name's Nicole.
My name's Ben, and you're listening to Wicked and Grim,
a true crime podcast. In the air.
And part two is here. I know a few people waited an extra week because they like to compress part one and part two. But it's nice and warm weather. Spring is in the air. We have chicks that are in our house and really loud as they are like super massive.
And chicks outside, or not chicks, chickens outside. And this is funny. We need to catch this on camera. Our chickens, which I think a lot do, they sing some sort of egg song when they lay an egg. I don't know if they're letting us know or a rooster or whatever.
I think it's communication with a rooster, supposedly.
But our one dog, Ripley, whenever they're singing this egg song, she will howl with them.
Yeah, typical husky. So she gets talking with the chickens. So the chickens are talking and the husky's talking. It's quite the sight.
It's amazing. We need to get this on some sort of video.
I think so. It'd be funny. Yeah.
But we had some geese fly over our home this morning, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, those
speaking
good old
birds.
Good old Canadian attack birds coming home for the summer.
Yeah. Yeah. So that means I think we're in the clear here.
Be careful. Be careful what you say, because you never know what's going to happen.
It is only March and it's Canada, so.
We've had some pretty big snowfalls in like late April, and so you never know.
Mm-hmm.
You never freaking know.
That's true. But I have a good feeling this time. I have
I got
a good
feeling.
I can feel it in my bones.
Yeah, well, I can feel it in the air. It's still not summer. Spring and fall are the same as winter in Canada. Summer is like Mexico, but spring and fall, it's winter.
Yeah, touche. Okay, so we have some lovely patrons to thank, do we not?
We do. I got a whole schwack load right here on my phone ready to thank. So starting with Becca, Karen Shoemaker, Alexandria Fabian, Scott Eagley, Vanessa Lee, and Julie Snyder. Thank you all very much for showing us the love and support over on Patreon. You guys are incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to say anything just yet because we just figured this out, but I might as well say it now. We are working on ads-free for Patreon.
We are.
So this episode and last episode are the starting markers for getting ads-free. We're not going back to our whole library, but from here on out, you can get ads-free by signing up on Patreon. The only caveat is I know we have a lot of listeners on Spotify. Spotify currently is not supporting it with our hosting platform, Acast.
Yeah.
So you can get ads free. You just have to listen on a different platform, unfortunately.
Hopefully that's something maybe they got on their list.
I really hope so. I was talking to them just the other day and they were like, because I was trying to figure this all out. And they said that that's kind of on Spotify shoulders. But I was also like, yeah, but you guys need to request it though too. So hint, hint, nudge, nudge, you know?
Yeah.
So like if you guys want it, you're not going to like sit back and just hope they do it. You got to like go for it. So hopefully if I harass them a little bit, maybe it might make something happen.
We'll just keep nudging in there, you know?
Yeah.
And it's almost the end of the month, which means that patrons are going to have an exclusive episode here pretty dang quick.
Definitely. So next episode and the exclusive episode is most likely going to be recorded on the road because you and I are hitting a road trip for a few days over Easter.
We are.
So
with the doggos, it's going to be a grand time.
Yeah. So there's a good chance that those are going to be recorded when we're just chilling out somewhere. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay. So I feel like, you know, I actually didn't get too much flack.
You guys called you out big time.
Yeah, on Patreon. Thanks, Larissa. But I just pinned it on you.
Yeah, I saw that. Thanks.
Okay, so we're going to just get right in here. I have a little bit of a recap that I'm going to read just to refresh your memory, you know. So we had a family of six. There's three generations. They met up in Wells Gray Provincial Park for a two-week camping adventure. Unfortunately, the families didn't return as expected, and the park was searched tirelessly for any sign of the missing families. Eventually, the Johnsons' car was found, which turned the case into a homicide investigation when all six members of the family's remains were found in the burned-out Chrysler.
Right.
We talked about how the investigation was very thorough, even leading the team across Canada in a nearly exact duplicate of the Bentley's truck and camper unit. Mm-hmm. And at the end of part one, we were just introduced to David Shearing, who appeared to not be the best of characters with the investigation team set to interview him. Does that all ring a bell there?
It really does, yeah. Because he was up north in, what was the place? Tumbler Ridge. I was going to say with the dinosaur footprints.
Yeah.
He was chilling up there. Gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So with the police in Tumbler Ridge already being familiar with Shearing for possession of stolen property charge and an upcoming court appearance scheduled for November 21st, getting Shearing in to talk to the team investigating the Bentley Johnson murders wasn't going to be all that difficult. But they wanted to do it in a way that caught him off guard in regards to this six murders. So we didn't have time to come up with some sort of story,
gotcha,
right?
Yeah.
Which I'm like, good on ya. He had just spent the night partying with a friend in Dawson Creek and was traveling back to Tumbler Ridge via bus when the investigating team was ready for him. They had grounds to arrest Shearing's friend, so that was the plan.
Okay.
They'd arrest him, the friend, take him back to Dawson Creek, and hope they could also convince Shearing to tag along without actually arresting him.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, you want a ride sort of thing?
Well, but it's interesting that it does work, but it's interesting because he was just in Dawson Creek, arrived to Tumbler Ridge, but now the police wanted to take them back to Tumbler Ridge.
Yeah.
So he was just like going back and forth. I'm not sure the distance. I think it's like an hour-ish. Quote me on that.
I can't remember. Last time I drove between those two was it's been a while.
Yeah. So they did have a backup plan, though. If he did not want to go back, they were going to bring up the hit and run that he was supposedly involved in back in 1980.
Okay.
But with the promise of a ride back to Tumbler Ridge after being questioned, Shearing did agree to go.
Who can turn down a free ride, right? Why not? You don't have to pay for gas. You just get home. You can have your drinks with your buddy who now is arrested and the police are going to escort you home. Sounds like a great free cab ride.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty sure I'd be like, nah, I'm good.
Yeah, but to a drunken redneck hillbilly in what year was this?
1982.
Yeah, to a drunken redneck hillbilly in the 80s. Sounds
but
great.
He was already home.
Oh, he was.
And they want to take him back to where he just came from.
Oh, I thought he was out somewhere at his buddy's place and they wanted to take him
they
home.
They were partying Okay. It's very confusing. They were partying in Dawson Creek.
Yes.
They live in Tumbler Ridge.
Yes.
So they took a bus to Dawson Creek to party.
Yes.
Then they were coming back to Tumbler Ridge and Tumbler Ridge is like, no, you need to go back to Dawson Creek for questioning.
I see.
So it's like this back and forth bullshit.
I missed the bus portion.
It's honestly surprising that he agreed because I think I'd be like, no. But he has already been in trouble with the law and probably doesn't want to piss him off. And he's knew he wasn't arrested. It was just questioning. So he's like, fine.
They might have like played the card like, hey, you know, like help look after your buddy. Because once he's done questioning, like you can help get him home or something.
Yeah.
It might have been that. And then he saw like pictured as the good guy taking care of his
Touché.
Friend.
Touché. I think he kind of liked being pictured that way.
Yeah. I'm also honestly picturing him because you keep saying his last name, Shearing.
Yeah.
I'm just picturing Ed Sheeran.
Oh my God. Poor Ed. Okay. Saturday, November 19th of 1983. This is 15 months since the time of the murders. Sergeant Eastham, the lead investigator on the case, finally got his chance to talk to Shearing. We've been working for this. They technically didn't have a lot of hard evidence against him, but they felt in their gut that he was their man. And sometimes you just got to listen to that gut feeling.
So, yeah, sometimes. But I don't know. I feel like as an investigator, though, you have to follow the facts over your gut.
You do. But I'm one of those people that have my gut's usually not wrong. So, I mean, some people, I think it sounds so funny, their gut. Like, how is their gut leading them? But some people, I feel like, have more intense gut feelings than other people.
Understandable. So. I just want to make my stance. Like, gut feelings, generally, yeah, they're the things to follow. However, as an investigator, as a job, you need to be able to disconnect yourself and follow the evidence and the facts first.
True. So the goal was to get him to confess without a lawyer involved, but also not to have Shearing feel that Wright was being taken away from him either. They wanted to follow the book. There was no way after all their hard work, they were going to have Shearing back on the streets from an error on their part. So reading how Eastham went about preparing for the interview was like fascinating. It almost seemed like it was a form of art. So introduce yourself, get them comfortable by offering them coffee, some smokes.
As you're pouring coffee.
This was the 80s, right? So smokes, they could smoke in the interrogation room. Get them talking about their life, maybe good stuff in their life, like their parents. Make them feel really good about them.
You're buddy-buddying up to them.
Yeah. Establish a friendship in a very short period of time and also be familiar. So Shearing was a bit of a cowboy. So the members of the four members on this investigating team, they presented themselves as a cowboy. They were also cowboys that day. Eastham, he even wore a cowboy hat, jean shirt, and leather vest.
Oh, snap.
Like, they went next level.
Put
I was
his
so
good
impressed.
Levi's that day.
I was impressed. So Eastham began. He asked Shearing how long he'd been in Tumblr Ridge, if he had a job at the moment, which he did have one up until 2 weeks ago. And he asked him to tell him a bit about himself, starting with his parents. Like I had mentioned in part one, Shearing's dad passed away from cancer the previous spring. He was rightfully so very upset about this, but he had begun drinking heavily and started getting into more trouble within a month or so after the funeral. As Eastham proceeded asking Shearing about his life, he began to relax, which is exactly what they were after. Because when he first came in there, you know, he's like arms crossed, which are Eastham said, you're not going to get anything from anyone in there.
No.
So as they're talking to him, you know, Shearing's arms started to hang down by his side and, you know, he could tell that he was like,
relaxing.
He was opening up. And
I've watched a lot of interrogation room sort of stuff on YouTube, mind you. It's not anything scientifical by any means. But I've watched a lot of these sort of things where they break down body language of people's demeanor changing for the better and for the worse, right? Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating, the slouches, or like how when they'll leave a room, for example, and they'll, like, of course now modern day we have cameras running, and they read that body language when they're gone, and they'll leave the room for an extended period of time for no reason. They'll just let you stew, and then they'll come back with like a quick comment, oh yeah, did you want a coffee or something, I'll go grab you one. And taking it, like getting a coffee should take like 2 minutes, but then they take like 10, like things like that.
And you're kind of, why are they taking so long?
Yeah. And then they look for that body language change on your own. And then they also look for it, of course, like you're saying, when they're trying to get you to relax and open up.
Yeah. I am a very awkward person, especially with my body language, I feel like. So I'm not sure if I would ever like fully open up in a situation like that where I felt like I looked relaxed. I don't know.
There's so many things to read, though. Like a glance at the door could mean something.
Yeah.
Nodding your head or looking left versus right, fidgeting with your fingers or your hands in your lap or down to your side. Are you sitting up straight? Are your feet out? Are you turned away? Like, there's so many things. Mm-hmm. And I can think of things, but I mean, I probably don't know what they really mean.
Yeah.
But
wow.
I highly recommend you dive into that rabbit hole because it's good.
Yeah, it's a whole form of art, like I said to it, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So After much small talk, Eastham finally got to the important stuff and asked Shearing if he knew why he was here, which he responded that he wasn't actually too sure, that he didn't have anything to hide, and he was an honest guy. He also asked if they were the guys investigating the Johnson-Bentley murders. So Shearing asked this, which to Eastham, considered this strike one, that he was aware that they were investigating that.
Oh, yeah.
Because they had not said anything to that extent yet.
No kid. And they're in a completely different town right now, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, they are. Well, he knew, I think, that this investigating team was from Kamloops. So maybe, I don't know. But
he
would have been reading something and saw their names or something.
Or pictures or something. Yeah, he would have known.
Because even when Shearing came into the detachment and Eastham introduced himself or whatever, there was something in Shearing, like a little bit of a holy fuck kind of thing. So like he knew. They chatted about that briefly. Eastham had previously been interviewed about the murders because the police, remember, were going door to door in Clearwater.
Yeah.
They let him know that a lot of the citizens in Clearwater were eager to help them with the investigation just to make Shearing stir in his seat a little bit. Like, you know, they have a lot of people on their side here to help with this. And then they brought up the hit and run incident from a couple years ago to surprise Shearing and had him relax once again, thinking this was actually the only reason that they called him in. He quickly and easily admitted to this incident. Of course, right? It's still a murder, which is horrible, but it's not six murders. So he hit and killed Dave Carter. He left the scene of the crime and he did not report it to police because he had had a few drinks. They got this admitted in a written statement by Shearing, and he even like initialed and.
And they probably went with along the conversation of like, yeah, like, oh, like you, like if you fully had like do a written statement on this, like, well, it was an accident. Like,
yeah,
we'll get this brushed under the rug.
Well, yeah, like even Eastham said, I mean, you're probably not going to get much for that, like 2 years or something, right? Which I'm sorry, but that's still terrible. So once that was complete, Eastham switched gears and asked Shearing what he thought about the Johnson and Bentley murders, how they were killed so close to home, to his home. He said it was pretty bad for the community. He then asked, do you know where the car was found? Shearing said, yeah. He then asked, do you know where the truck was found? Shearing responded, yeah, again. Then he said, you also know where they were killed? And he responded, Bear Creek, which was actually a piece of holdback information no one outside of the RCMP had known for sure where the murders had taken place.
I was going to say they're going to bait him with something. Yeah.
That was strike two.
Damn.
Realizing the question he had just answered, Shearing said, I think I need to speak to a lawyer now.
Yeah, no shit.
Eastham distracted that thought, though. He said, you know what? Let's get a coffee. I'll go get you a coffee. Would you like one? So he did that. He returned with the coffees. He agreed with Shearing that he did need a lawyer, but continued distracting him with conversation until he said, you knew we'd come for you, didn't you, David? To which David, or Shearing, agreed. And that was strike three.
What an idiot.
I know.
You knew we'd come for you. Yeah, I did. What? You just admitted this shit. Like, what the fuck?
But like Eastham said in the book, I mean, a lot of people, they do terrible things and they feel like they do want to get it off their chest, right?
I'm sure.
So the interview continued with Shearing little by little revealing how he had seen the six family members camping on his way home from work. Later that evening, he went for a short walk through the bush and found himself heading to their campsite. He watched them curiously for some time before heading home. The next night, he returned with his .22. He had first shot all four adults. Then he moved on to the two girls who were in bed in the tent at the time and shot them dead as well. He placed the bodies of the adults in the back seat of the Johnson's car, as we know, and the two girls' bodies in the trunk. He collected everything that was lying around the campsite and stuffed it in the camper before driving both the car and truck to a clearing about 300 or 400 feet from the scene until he dealt with them in the coming days. During this time, he even went about illustrating two drawings for the investigators, one of them indicating where he had left some of the victim's stolen possessions and another describing the crime scene. So he's just drawn his life away, really, which, you know what? Good. Like,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, they just give him some fucking Crayola crayons and he's just like sitting here doodling, happening to as a pig in shit.
Yeah, I think he did like four or five fucking illustrations. So
sounds like he's reveling in this, honestly.
Yeah, I don't know. It's odd to me that he just went about it, but I think he also realized like he's not going to get away with this at this point.
Yeah. I mean, he already admitted it.
Yeah. Shearing went on to say that he had looted the camper of anything he thought was valuable and that this was the motivation for him behind the crimes.
That's the motivation?
Yeah.
I was waiting for the that's it.
Yeah. I mean, he likes stealing shit and selling
what
it.
What the fuck?
He agreed to be taken to the murder site and the two locations the vehicles were found to reenact his crimes. Additionally, more stolen items of the victims were recovered by police at Shearing's parents' ranch where he was living at the time. On Monday morning, November 21st, 1983, Shearing appeared in court and was charged with six counts of second-degree murder. On April 16th, 1984, Shearing pleaded guilty to those six counts of second-degree murder. And the following day, he was sentenced to concurrent terms of life imprisonment with no possibility of parole for 25 years. And this was the first time in Canadian history that 25 years was given on a second degree murder charge.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Which I'm like,
yeah, good. Glad.
Thank you.
No shit.
The fact that he just like, you know, pleaded guilty and everything. It's just so interesting, hey?
I mean, like you say, he knew he was caught, and some people like that just kind of want to get it off their chest almost. The thing that really gets me is that he found himself walking towards the campsite.
Yeah.
And then he watched them and then just came back with the 22 to kill them all and steal some shit in their camper.
Yeah.
Like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yep.
Like, what?
But this would be a pretty quick damn episode, eh? So you're ready for some more?
I was actually looking at the time. I was like, oh, it's like 20 minutes.
So for all intents and purposes, the case was over.
Except?
But Eastham, who lived with this case for almost 2 years, wanted to cash in what he felt he was owed.
Oh, fuck.
Before the trial, Eastham made a deal with Shearing, saying when the trial was over, he wanted the truth from the convicted killer. He never believed that Shearing took six innocent lives just to steal some of their possessions.
Yeah, I don't believe it either. That's bullshit.
And though he had a good idea, he wanted to know what the real motive behind the murders was.
Okay, thank you. Because like this was absurd to me. I'm like, how? Like he could have fucking parted out the vehicles for more than what he's getting in the camper. The cooler, the food in the cooler probably would have been more than what they've got in the camper. Like it's bullshit.
Do you have any idea what the real motive may have been?
No.
You're not going to like this, Ben.
Was it sexual?
While the rest of the RCMP team involved in the case went out to celebrate their success.
Wow.
Eastham found Shearing. He was now 25 and he was in a police holding cell waiting to be processed and transferred to prison. And he gave him one last try. Shearing received the equivalent to a first-degree murder sentence and couldn't receive more than 25 years without eligibility for parole. So Eastham felt he really had nothing to lose by telling him what he wanted to know. He laid it right on the table and said, "There's a couple things that don't sit well with me, and you know what they are. What's gnawing at me right now is I think you sexually abused those girls before you killed them."
Yeah, and I knew it. I fucking knew it.
"You told me some time ago that you would consider telling me the rest of the story after you were sentenced. Well, I'm here to collect, David, and I'm not taking no for an answer."
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Oh, I'm like shaking because this shit just, yeah. Shearing contacted his lawyer because by law, he didn't actually have to tell Eastham anything. But his lawyer instructed Shearing that whatever he was going to tell him was his decision, knowing that Eastham still had some power with the parole report he would be writing. So Shearing gave in, and he said, "I guess I saw them there at the Bear Creek site one of those nights on my way home from work. I think it was Thursday or Friday. I saw the family there, a couple of older folks and two young girls. I guess I got it in my mind that I wanted them." Apparently, during the investigation, it was determined Shearing had an interest in young girls. An older woman in his universe was about 16 years old. Whether it was some sort of sick social behavior or perhaps a lack of self-confidence, young girls were in his life and he related to them. He said, "I went back and I'm not sure if it was that night or the following night, I knew I was going to have to kill those other four to get to the girls."
I fucking knew it.
I
fucking knew it.
It takes just it's just beyond disturbing.
Yeah.
When he returned the following night, he watched the family in the bush for about 45 minutes, waiting for the girls to go to bed. And once he was satisfied that they were in bed, he went for it. He crept behind the camper with his rifle in hand. When one of the women actually saw him, she started standing up and Shearing yelled out, "Don't move, I got a gun." Then Bob Johnson, which is the dad, stood up and he shot him. He thought he hit him in the throat because he was gurgling and making a lot of noises. George Bentley then started running towards the truck because I believe he had a gun in there.
Mm-hmm.
And Shearing shot him next to the passenger side door. Jackie, the mother of the girls, started running to the tent and she was shot in the head. Finally, Edith was trying to get into the camper and Shearing came up behind her and shot her in the head as well. Once the adults were all dead, the obstacles were out of his way.
Yeah. I'm like, this makes so much sense in my head.
Yeah.
Because the whole idea of, I raided some shit in the camper. It fucking made no sense. He found himself just walking to their site. I'm like, what? And then watching for a while and then going back and coming. Like, there's a fucking purpose for what he claimed. And as far as I knew, there was no attachments from that or no like personal knowledge of who these people were. So when you're like,
they did nothing wrong to him whatsoever.
So when you're like, do you know what the motive could be? I mean, the only fucking thing is sexual.
Mm-hmm.
And that fucking makes me sick.
Like a nasty mofo.
This dude's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
He makes my blood boil so much.
I know. It is beyond disturbing. He went over to the tent and told the girls that there were some bad people out there and that their parents had told him to stay back so they could go and get help. Apparently, while the girls stayed in the tent, Shearing shot their dad a second time as he was still alive, and he loaded the bodies of the four adults into the back seat of the family car and covered them with a blanket. Then after cleaning up some of the campsite, he crawled into the tent with the girls. And in the book, Eastham didn't go into much detail. He just said Shearing was lucky he wasn't armed at the time, like as he was confessing this.
Yeah. Wow.
Shearing then said after he got dressed that he and the girls took down the tent and cleaned up the rest of the site. They asked him where their parents were a couple of times, but they did everything he said that like he wanted them to do. So he figured they believed him when he said that they were off getting help. Eastham did not believe this. He knew the little girls would have most likely seen everything, being that the scene outside of the tent would not have been a quiet one. And the reason they were listening to him was because they were scared out of their fucking minds.
Yep, definitely. 100%.
Shearing then drove the girls in the car. Their dead parents and grandparents were piled in the back seat of this car, and he drove them to the family ranch. At the ranch, he got the girls set up in the tent and told them the bad people, or biker people, as he referred to them as, were still looking around for them, so they had to stay put. And he walked back to the campsite to retrieve the truck/camper. When he returned, Shearing told the girls he had saved their parents and helped them get away, stating that the girls thought of him as a hero.
Yeah, I'm sure they fucking didn't.
Yeah. Shearing continued to keep them alive for nearly a week.
Oh, fuck.
Staying with them both at his family ranch and a small fishing cabin on the Clearwater River. They had left the cabin after they were nearly discovered. A prison guard was supervising prisoners from a local jail who were fishing on the river, and he actually came to the door of the cabin to tell Shearing, like, not to be alarmed. And Shearing had the girls hide behind the door and told them to stay quiet, and the guard unfortunately didn't notice anything unusual with the encounter, which is just, like, makes your heart just fucking sink, hey?
Yeah, I can't imagine the fucking hell those girls would have gone through in that week.
Yeah.
Wow.
When the coast was clear, Shearing said he took the girls back to his ranch. Then one at a time, he took each girl for a walk in the woods, told them to turn around so he could piss, shot them in the back of the head. He did this first to 11-year-old Karen so that he could have a night alone with Janet in the camper, telling her he had tied his sister to a tree. Eastham knew Shearing had left out a lot of details, but he knew enough. No one will ever know the extents of the torment the girls suffered after the death of their parents and grandparents.
Holy shit. What a fucking absolute monster.
Yeah, I know. Those girls were 11 and 13. Like, it makes me... it's hard to even put in words what it makes you feel.
Yeah.
Because it is so disturbing, so sad, and just gut-wrenching.
Holy shit.
To double-check the story, Eastham found the prison guard, Don Gordon, who remembered the meeting exactly as Shearing had described it. They also had a member of the team hike to the cabin where they found the initials DS, David Shearing, and JJ, Janet Johnson, carved into the wooden logs of the cabin. Today, Shearing is thankfully still serving time in prison. Now,
he fucking rot.
I know.
Wow.
Now retired, Sergeant Eastham is determined that Shearing remains in prison. He believes that if he's ever released, that he will kill again.
I hope he fucking rots for life. 100%. I am definitely with Eastham on this.
Yeah. I mean, because that is just, it's just too far what he did. Like, it's too much.
Oh, yeah.
I mean.
100%. I mean, killing people, like, don't get me wrong. That's fucking too far. But then he took this even farther and farther and farther. And holy shit.
Yeah.
Like, wow.
So Shearing, who now goes by his mother's maiden name, Ennis, married a lady named Heather in 1995. And I really hate to judge here, but who in their right mind would reach out to someone like Shearing to start a relationship with them? Like, I honestly just can't fucking comprehend that.
Yeah, I don't know.
And I also don't think that Shearing should have that fucking opportunity, in my opinion.
I don't think so either.
Do Karen and Janet have that opportunity to get married?
No.
So that to me is just beyond fucked. Shearing has applied for parole numerous times since he's been eligible. The last time being in 2021, he told the parole panel that he had sexual fantasies, including rape and murder, from when he was in his mid-teens. He thought that was, like, a normal thought that men have. The board heard 9 emotional victim impact statements demanding the board reject his application. They said he is the exact same monster he was in 1982. Also, more than 100,000 names were collected through change.org on a petition to ensure Shearing was denied. And that is how I found out about this case, I believe, because I signed that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, back in 2021. So Shearing apologized to the families.
You didn't send the petition to me. I would have signed it. It would have been like 100,001 signatures.
It was 100,000 plus. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know how. I actually get change.org emails once in a while, so I'm not really sure why. But anyway, I did sign it. I had a hand in keeping him in prison. I hope he stays there freaking ever.
No shit.
Shearing apologized to the families. He said he better understands their pain and how powerful feelings and has powerful feelings of shame and regret. I do apologize to all, especially to the victims, for the impact that it has had on them. He added that he has lived with powerful feelings of shame and regret. Sorry, I kind of already said that. The board was told that Shearing had been attending sex offender programs and worked in the prison chapel. But ultimately, they rejected his application, saying Shearing still has deviant sexual fantasies. Stating, when we look at your assessed risk, together with your diagnosis of sexual sadism, which largely remains unchanged, the most appropriate place for you to make gains is in the safety and security of the institution. And we can only hope that he remains there until the day he dies, really.
Wow.
And that's the case.
I can't believe he just sits here and thinks that, oh, you know, aren't these fucking fantasies just normal for a dude? Fucking excuse me.
Yeah.
It's normal for no one.
I know. To even think that like, that is remotely normal is just beyond me.
What is normal? And I will say this. What is normal is having fantasies, is having desires. And I don't care. And I do not judge the extent of those fantasies and desires. You can fantasize about whatever the fuck you want. Mm-hmm. It's when you put it into action, there's fucking lines. Like if there's people out there who they are genuinely attracted to children. Fucking sickens me to my stomach, but that's how they're born.
Yeah.
The moment they take that into the real world, not fucking cool. It's not.
Well, I know. I don't know. You almost think like, is there a way to get help? But can you actually, for lack of better words, cure that?
I don't know.
So.
But I'm like, there's people out there with fantasies of all sorts. And like the extreme one is like with children. Mm-hmm. Fuck, that just gives me the creeps to mm-hmm. just talk about that. But there's people out there with dominance fantasies. Mm. We'll take that one because it's a little bit more common.
Yeah.
So they want to be dominated. Okay. Fantastic. Or the person wants to dominate someone. We'll take that one because that might be actually a really good way to use it. So if you fantasize about dominating a person, you need to have things like a safe word. You need to have consent with your partner and understanding the limitations. Mm-hmm. As soon as you go past those limitations, as soon as you don't respect the safe word, it's not okay anymore.
No.
And so fantasies and how far you take it, there's going to be a line.
Oh, yeah.
100%. 100%. So fantasies, no matter what, in my opinion, you fantasize, but whatever the fuck you want to fantasize. Keep that in your fucking head to yourself. Mm-hmm. Don't make that someone else's problem.
So I wanted to shout out the book I read again. It was titled The Seventh Shadow by Michael Eastham with Ian McLeod. And he said that he wrote this book so we don't forget, which I think is super good. I also have a couple talking points. So it's just like things that didn't really fit into the case. This is sort of a new thing.
Okay.
I don't know why. I have like bullets here, just talking points. So anyway, if you want to stay around for that, let's do it. Some of them are just tidbits. Some of them are talking points. So
what's the difference between a talking point and a tidbit?
A tidbit is probably something that you're not going to really want to respond to much like this.
I thought a tidbit was what you get at Tim Hortons. Sorry.
Ooh.
Sorry, my phone was ringing. My bad.
Okay, so this is a tidbit. The charred remains of all six victims apparently fit inside one baby-sized casket.
Oh, shit.
Which is horrible.
That is horrifying. Wow.
Yeah. So, I also wanted to talk about the impacts of parole hearings on victims.
Okay.
Because this is something that I just think is brutal. It's just so brutal that their victims, they've had to endure so much. And then just literally it just gets fucking repeatedly brought up. Like I mean, I get that people can be rehabilitated and stuff at times, but I do think that not everyone can. And I think bringing victims through that is horrible. It's just horrible.
It prolongs what what they went through.
And they're healing. Every time it comes up, it's like opening up new wounds and stuff. Yeah. And I just don't think it's okay.
Well, there's this, it literally reminded me of this old song by Randy Travis, Digging Up Bones. And the whole thing is about how he and his wife separated, and he's going through things in the house. He's digging up these memories. He's reliving these things. And that's exactly what fucking happens when, I mean, someone's coming up for parole. Now you have to go to a fucking parole hearing. You are literally, as Randy Travis put it, digging up these fucking bones, mm-hmm. and you're having to re-fucking live it all.
Yeah. This, and I meant to look it up, but during this time period, the family had also the parole, like, time spans in between got changed. And mm-hmm. I think it was because of this case, because they were like, you know, it's not fair that this is brought up, like, however so often, right? It's just brutal. Yeah.
At least minimize that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some breathing room.
Something that I wasn't sure if you realized, but were you not surprised that it was a second degree murder charge?
Actually, I kind of was. I wasn't going to say anything because he got the 25 years for a second degree. But yes, I was actually kind of surprised with that.
Yeah. And the whole time I was like, what the fuck? Like, he literally came back. Like, he planned this.
Yeah. He went there, watched them for a while, left, got his gun, came forth.
Yeah.
Waited for his moment. Like, that's premeditated.
It totally is. They technically couldn't prove that Shearing had been at the campsite the night before he committed the murders, and that is why the charge was second degree.
Wouldn't.
But he kind of admitted it, so that's kind of like, the fuck?
But, I mean, you still need proof of it. And I think, for me, the proof of it would have been, and I mean, this could be different in court, of course. For me, the proof is, even if he didn't go there the first time, say the first time that he went to the campsite was when he had his gun in hand. Mm-hmm. He still walked the distance from his place to the campsite with that gun in hand.
Yeah.
What was the intent of that gun? It's a .22 caliber. It's not for protection against a fucking bear, I can tell you that, because that's not taking down a bear. So what's the intent of carrying a .22 caliber gun?
Well, and then even when he arrived there the night of, he waited 45 minutes.
Exactly.
To make sure, like, the girls were in bed.
Exactly. He's premeditation doesn't need a day prior. Premeditation could be 5 fucking minutes.
Yeah.
He stood there with his gun watching, like you say, for 45 minutes. As I said, he made the walk prior to that, just rounded up and say an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. That's an hour and a half of premeditation.
Yeah.
And then sneaking through the campsite.
So, I mean, I was kind of upset when I had seen that, but then the fact that he had gotten, you know, the maximum anyway.
Yeah,
that's kind of why. Because, like, he would have gotten that if it was first degree anyway. Yeah.
Or so, how about this with the girls? Hey, turn around while I take a leak.
I know. He knew that he wasn't going to be keeping those girls alive.
That's classic of mice and men. You know, look at the rabbits. He premeditated that. That's exactly what he fucking did. Turn around so I can shoot you in the head. That is premeditation.
I know. Oh, gosh. You can't think about what those girls went through too intently, because it will just, like, destroy you.
Oh, I'm making a point to try not fucking think of it.
Okay, two more things. So the adults, the four, and this is just, like, I don't even know why I'm bringing this up. Sorry. I apologize. But the four adults remained in the backseat of the Johnson's car until he killed those girls, right? And then he put those girls in there and then drove that car up there. So they were, like, decomposing in there for, like, a week.
Wow. I didn't think about that.
Which is...
just gross.
Yeah.
And those, like... damn near desecration of their fucking remains, honestly.
Yeah. But, like, I mean, for him to even go in that vehicle and then drive it like that, I mean, God, this guy is just...
You would have needed a lot of Febreze. A lot of Febreze to drive that fucking car. Yeah,
but clearly we know that he doesn't have all his ducks in a row here.
No, no.
So that's to put it real nicely.
He ain't got no ducks.
There's zero ducks.
No.
Okay, and this one, just, like, reading Eastham's story, and it's from, like, a, you know, an investigator's perspective and stuff, but they just put so much time and so much energy and, investing in cases just consumes their life, right? For upwards of 2 years or whatever. And it's just bizarre to me. Like, I don't even know how you would go about it that, okay, this, you know, they got the outcome of this that they wanted where Shearing, you know, is in prison for extended period of time. But then just to go and move on to your next case.
Yeah.
I don't even know how you would do that. I feel like those people are in a way like kind of superheroes in a sense. How do you do that?
I mean, this is only like a fraction of it. And I'm talking like a fraction of a fucking fraction, like 0.01% of that. But I mean, we in a sense kind of do that with this case. We research cases each week, right? And you kind of got to move on to the next case. And lots of times we force ourselves to almost forget the last one so we can research the other one. Now, mind you, like I said, that's a small fraction of the reality of what they're doing, because they spend years, the actual emotions, the face-to-face.
Seeing.
Yes, experiencing all of it. But I mean, you got to do what you got to do.
I know.
And what he's doing is ensuring that he's bringing justice to his people. So I think he's putting what he has to aside so he can.
I know, but it was just almost, I was wondering, do they get, you know, time off in between, or is it like, okay, next day, here's your next fucking case.
Sure there's things like stress leave and all that sort of stuff.
Because you would have to decompress to some extent before you moved on, I think, in a way.
Well, and there's vices to help people through. Like, think of like old detective films and stuff like that. The detective is always at his desk with like pouring a glass of whiskey, and like he's like all stressed and shit, and he's doing what he can to move on and get this case solved. And, you know, so I have a feeling that at least somewhat comes from reality.
Yeah.
Think of PTSD and, you know, all that sort of stuff, right?
I know. RCMP, you know, gosh, what they have to experience and go through cannot be easy.
No, definitely not.
So I closed my laptop because we're done, but now we don't have our little graphic on the monitor. So sorry about that.
Good job. But that was well done. Good job. As you mentioned last time, the book that you read is going to be going into a giveaway thing that we're doing here soon.
It's very cool.
So if you want to be kept up to date on that, you can check out Patreon. Link is down below. You can sign up. Not only get a heads up on that, but you can support the show. Mm-hmm. And you can just support by, you know, giving us a review, listening, doing what you're doing right now. So thank you very much. We appreciate you guys.
We do appreciate you guys big time.
So good job on the case.
Yeah. You know, I'm kind of glad because that was very consuming for 2 weeks, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm going to, I don't know, soak in some sun maybe.
Yeah. Good idea.
So until next time, hey?
Until next time.
Stay wicked.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.